And welcome to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. Let's get right into the show today. And of course, it's autumn and it's apple picking time. So I wanted to feature a great little place that you can go apple picking here in the local area, actually in Hudson, Quebec, and where the apples are organic. They are not sprayed with any pesticides. And that's at the Verger de Hudson Biologique. And I spoke to Annick Joannis, who is the co-owner of Verger de Hudson Biologique. And we sat down right alongside the orchard and had a chat about what it's like having an organic orchard. Here is that interview now. This is Ryan Young with Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM, and I'm here with Annick Joannis, who is the co-owner of Verger de Hudson Biologique, an organic apple orchard in Hudson, Quebec. And how are you doing today?
I'm very well, thank you.
Thanks for doing this interview. And one of the things that I've noticed is, you know, your orchard is very close to the Ottawa River.
Yes.
We're kind of on the banks of the Ottawa River, across the street from the water side of the road. And why is that good for an apple orchard?
Well, you need a microclimate in an apple orchard. Well, you actually need it for a lot of different productions. Specifically in the apple orchard, the flowers bloom in mid-May. Mid-May, you still have the chance of frost. And so your blooms are, you know, are subject to frost between 8 and 10 days. Now that period sounds like it's a very short period, but when you're living it, it's extremely long because that danger is there. And, you know, we had the proof again this year with a lot of orchards and a lot of wine producers who did have frost and lost their entire crop. So it's a very important feature of an orchard or a wine growers to have a microclimate. So the lake is giving off heat, basically. And so it could make the difference between that, you know, that degree where your flowers freeze and fall off or they don't.
And some of these people that you know that lost their crop, what does an apple orchardist do when they lose their crop?
Well, a lot of apple orchardists, you know, have crop insurance. We personally don't believe in crop insurance. We, you know, sort of make do with whatever nature gives us for that particular year. And, you know, we're very creative, so we do often find ways to make ends meet if we need to. But otherwise, yeah, normally they will have insurance for that.
And some varieties may flower a little later, right?
So, yes.
So you might,
yes.
If you have a diverse variety
exactly.
Of apples.
Yes, maybe. Exactly. Yeah. We thought we might lose our earlier apples. We thought if we're losing anything, because we did have a, you know, one night where it was really down to the wire, and Eric was building fires to, you know, try to keep the temperature up in the orchard, and so we thought, well, maybe we will lose some of our earlier apples because they bloom earlier, and they were in full bloom than some of the other varieties. But it turns out that I don't know if the fires worked, but we have a crop.
Nice. And I do notice on your farm that it's not always just apples. Sometimes you've got pear trees or cherry trees or plum trees. Is that just out of personal interest, or is that like how you might want to expand? Or?
Well, I would say mostly out of personal interest. And also, you know, we listen to our clients, we listen to our customers, and if they're asking us for plums, they want to know if we have plums. Well, you know what? Let's do plums. Let's do pears. We like to stick to fruit trees, and we also have Saskatoon berries. So that's the little berry that we do, is the little shrub, and it does very well. So it's normally found, you know, in the Canadian prairies, and it does really well here. So we do have those. But, you know, whatever sort of piques our interest. Right now, I'm really interested in planting les groseilles.
Mm-hmm. Not currants? Is that currants?
No, it's not currants.
Gooseberries?
Gooseberries.
Okay.
So I'm really, really into gooseberries, and we're looking at a test spot for gooseberries, because they're really quite good. They resemble a raisin in their texture. They're very crunchy, and they've just got a really great taste, and they make the great is the greatest jam. So they're very, very naturally high in pectin.
And is that Hascap berry then, maybe?
Nope. So Hascap berry is different. La Camerise is different.
And you're interested in that too, maybe?
Camerise, well, they do a lot in Lac-Saint-Jean. So the Camerise, I think, was first introduced to, because it's an earlier fruit, it's earlier than blueberries, and it was introduced in Saguenay because they already do blueberries, and they already have the equipment and the infrastructure for that type of berry. Yes, so I'm sticking to the Saskatoon berry because I do it well, and gooseberries are definitely on my radar for the next few years.
Hmm. Why did you want to avoid growing apples conventionally with chemicals?
Well, when we first started planting, we were in our early 20s, and we knew we wanted to have a family, and we knew we didn't want our kids growing up in a conventionally sprayed orchard. It was pretty obvious that wasn't the trend either. You know, I don't know why you would start any sort of agricultural business with the minding of conventional nowadays. I think it's out.
Yeah, yeah. So one of the things I know you do is there's a species of moth that you try to confuse. So can you give me a little bit of a story about that?
Yes.
How you deal with that organically?
So one of the ways that we try to control certain insects is with sexual confusion. So basically, we're putting traps in the orchard atop of the tree, because that is where the males will propagate and look for the female. And basically, we're putting the hormones, the female hormones, at the bottom of the tree, and they're looking for them at the top. And so that way, they're just simply not reproducing. So in organic agriculture, it's just a bunch of little tricks that you're sometimes playing on insects. So instead of systematically spraying and getting rid of everything, and in turn getting rid of everything that's beneficial, you're just basically playing tricks on them and convincing them that they're just not in the right place, and they know to go look somewhere else. So if you really want to have beautiful apples, you do have to treat your apples. And it's not even about beautiful, it's not about the way they look or the size that they are. It really is just, you don't want worms in your apples. That's basically it. So to achieve that, you do need to treat your apples. And we're treating them with mineral-based products. And so I would say over the past 18 years, there's been a lot of development in that sector. We've been a test orchard as well for organic growing. We do a lot of apples in Quebec. That's one of our major exports is apples. So, you know, it's important to do a lot of research in that sector, and that more people get on the wagon and become organic, because it is one of the most sprayed fruits.
I also heard once that they even will spray during certain years to change the sort of boom and bust cycle.
Yes,
absolutely. Which seems like a strange concept, because they're kind of destroying fruit, right?
Yes, we need to do that in organic agriculture as well, because fruits are cyclical. So apple trees will produce in high amounts every 2 years. So they'll produce in high amounts 1 year, and then the following year they will rest. And so the year that they are producing in high amounts, that's actually problematic as well, because you're breaking branches, your apples aren't growing as big as they should be, because there are six or seven of them all clustered together. So you need to thin. You need to thin in an orchard no matter what, whether you're doing it chemically or by hand. So conventionally, they're doing it by chemicals every year systematically, so you're teaching your orchard to grow more on a level base. And we do it by hand. So you can imagine that in the month of July, when the apples are about, 2 inches in diameter, we need to thin every single year. This year was a huge challenge because there are a lot of apples this year. This is our sort of bumper crop year. And it's quite an amount of labor. So it's labor-based versus chemical-based.
And then when you thin, you're just thinning by hand.
You're just thinning by hand. So you're looking at every branch, counting out the number of apples that are on there, thinning out the ones that are too clustered together. You want them to be more spread out on your branch, so you're not breaking your branch as well. And just to help your orchard along.
And so do you employ people every year for that, or are you able to do
the
work?
We do. We employ high season is maybe about 15 employees, high season. But otherwise, most of the labor is definitely us and the kids that are now grown and 18, 16, and 11. So they can do a lot.
classic. And what do you really like about having an apple orchard, just from even a spiritual side?
I would say just the different views and just everything that goes on in an orchard every single day, every single season. There's always something going on. There's always something you need to do because you're in February, you're pruning, so you've got your snowshoes on and you're walking on top of the snow to get to your trees and prune. There's just you're living with the seasons. You really are. We have our own bees, so because we're certified organic, we can keep our bees in the orchard versus conventional would be bringing in bees for pollination for about a period of 8 to 10 days and then removing them because you're using chemical insecticides and you'd be killing off your hives. So Eric took it upon himself, my husband, to start beekeeping and just absolutely fell in love with it. And so we have bees in the orchard, and that again, seasonally, it's just everything. There's always something going on. And just the views that you have every single day is different when there's a fog, when there's a rain, when there are clouds, when it's a bright sunshine. It's very, very peaceful, I must say. We're extremely lucky and we know it. We wake up every single day thinking about how lucky we are.
Mm. And in terms of diversity and trying to have more than just one variety of apple, what have you done there?
So we right now have 16 varieties of apples. Our criteria for choosing the varieties of apples is always number one, its resistance, the tree's resistance, or the variety's resistance to scab and disease. So that's criteria number one. Criteria number two is the taste. So we don't look at varieties in the sense of, will it produce equally sized apples? Will it produce apples that will travel well? That's not what we want to know. We want to know, is the tree going to survive well? Is it going to produce apples? Is it going to be more resistant to scab or certain diseases? And then taste, of course. So those are basically our criterias. And, you know, like anything, you don't want just one variety. Because if you have one variety and something does happen in your orchard, which it has happened to us, we've had, one major disease a few years ago that wiped out an entire variety. So 200 trees completely gone, and we just basically saved the rest. So we were really scared that our orchard was going to go. But because we had so many different varieties, a lot of the trees resisted and they responded well to, we basically had to cut down a lot of branches that had disease.
And was it fire blight?
It was fire blight, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the biggest enemy in organic agriculture, I want to say, is fire blight. Because when it starts, it's fire. It's exactly, the name says it. It's like just a fire that goes through your orchard. Mm-hmm. So we were very glad then that we had so many varieties and that we only lost one variety to fire blight.
And what variety was that?
It was called Prince William. And so we never planted that variety again.
And tell me about what it's like interacting with the public when you have an orchard, and because you do you pick here as well.
Yes.
And maybe for our listeners, I mean, we'll say it again at the end of the interview, but how people can come and buy your product. And
well, one of the best things that I love about having an apple orchard is holding you pick. Because we're an organic orchard, we're a little bit different. We really want to concentrate on the apples, why you're coming here. You're coming to pick apples. You're coming to spend time in the orchard. You're coming to spend time in our backyard, and we want you to enjoy it. And so that's why now we have a reservation system as well. COVID or not, it will stay because I think people are having a nicer time in the orchard as well, and it's not as crowded. And what I like to do mostly is, tell people about organic agriculture, and really so that they really understand, A, why they're paying a premium, because they are paying a premium. And, you know, when you explain things and people really do understand and they really do appreciate what you're doing. And just, talking about exactly, again, why we have different varieties. And it's like that for everything. We have different varieties in tomatoes, in green peppers, in red peppers. And, you know, it's important for people to realize where food is coming from. So, if you can enjoy a moment, a peaceful moment, ideally, in an orchard and really, take it all in, take the moment in, I think that's the best, that's the biggest reward for me for having, holding you pick.
Nice. And so you're generally open every day of the week, or?
Yes, we're open 7 days a week, 10 to 5. On weekends, we ask for reservations, Saturday and Sunday, simply on our website. It's all self-explanatory. And during the week, you don't need reservations. It's nice and quiet as well during the week, so you can come by and have a nice little U-pick. It doesn't take very long. The orchard is not very big. It's 3,000 trees, which is relatively small for a Quebec orchard. So, you know, there are no tractor rides. It's just you grab a wagon, you grab your box, and you can do a quick little pick. You can come more than once during the season. And that's sort of the point, too. The point is not to overload yourself with pounds and pounds and pounds of apples. The point is to maybe come, you know, for shorter amounts of time and pick what's fresh and enjoy it.
Nice, nice. And I see sometimes like birdhouses and stuff like
yes.
that. So why do you put up birdhouses?
So we have swallows, barn swallows. We realized that we have a few barns on the site. One of them is a 100-year-old barn. And we noticed that when the orchard started going up, and the bees as well, we realized that we had barn swallows. And they started moving in, and you know, barn swallows come back to the same nest every year. So it didn't take too long. Within a few years, we had about 6 or 7 couples coming back every year to the barn. And it didn't take long for us to realize, well, you know, this is their home, really. So, you know, they should be staying. And we realized how beneficial they really are. The amount of insects that they eat in one day that they consume is just phenomenal. And so throughout the orchard, we've started putting in new swallow houses. And so the ones that we have in the barn, now we're up to about 16 couples.
Wow.
So we're very proud of that because, you know, swallows are somewhat endangered in
they
Quebec.
Are. Yeah.
And so we're very proud of that. And like I said, we basically gave them the barn. We cover anything we need to. In terms of machinery, we just cover with tarps, and it's basically their barn. And throughout the orchard, they're bicolores.
Yeah, the hirondelle bicolore.
Yeah. So it's the hirondelle bicolore. So they're the ones taking up house in the orchard, and they're just they're magnificent, magnificent birds.
Nice. For an organic farmer that grows apples. Sometimes you hear about this more, I guess, in the growing of cash crops, more maybe like corn and soy. But, you know, it seems like the system is in favor of the conventional in terms of government grants and those kinds of things. Is that what you find?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Especially when you're starting out. So once you're established, then you have access to maybe more subsidies or more programs. But when you're starting out, which we were, we really went from nothing. So it took, years to be able to establish a business. The manner of the way the system is set up, rather, is quite difficult to deal with. So buying land, just right there, buying a smaller amount of land. So we have 57 arpents, and we had to split a piece of land in half. So the family farm was actually much bigger, and we wanted to buy 57 arpents. And that was extremely difficult because it was basically the attitude is go big or go home. So this isn't going to be viable. Nobody's going to live off this agriculture. It's not worth it. It's too small scale. We're not letting you do it, basically. So it took a few years to get that to happen. And then it took a few years to actually be able to live on the land, so to build a house and live here. So we weren't living here when we first established. And that was very difficult because, you know, as most people know, you're working sun up, sun down when in agriculture. And so that was quite difficult. We were building a family as well. And so that also took a few years. There are a lot of roadblocks, and you really have to believe in your project because, you know, I think it's gotten a little bit better now. I've heard that, it's a little bit easier to buy smaller plots of land, and they do believe that it is viable. And you have to prove that it's viable as well, which I completely understand. But, you know, if you haven't done it, you're not going to really know if it's viable or not as well, you know, and everybody's different. But you're right in saying that, agriculture is go big or go home.
Right, absolutely. And in terms of the local community, the town of Hudson or the MRC, do you have good relationships? Do you think they should
yes.
be doing more? Or?
We've had nothing but good, feedback from the town and also from the community. And I was hoping that this orchard would be a community-based orchard in the sense that Hudsonites and locals, all around, regional, I should say, would feel like it is their orchard. And, you know, we really do it for people. We don't do it. We're not doing it for us. You know, we do it so that people will enjoy it and that they'll have access to organic food. And we've had nothing but great feedback from them. And, for example, Hudson is still very much zoned agricultural. So there is so much room here for farms. You know, access to land, again, we all know, is one of the hardest things for farmers. But, you know, sometimes you need to think outside the box. And, you know, our deal with the land was basically pulled through on a handshake. And for a lot of years, we didn't even actually own the land before we started planting, but we started planting anyway. And so sometimes you have to think outside the box, and if you really want it, then it can happen.
Hmm. And was it easy to access your stock of trees? Like, did you buy them from
That was actually quite easy. So like I said, in Quebec, we do a lot of apple trees. You know, there are a lot of orchards. That's what we do. So that yes, is very accessible. And we were able to work with people from the Mac farm as well. And so, yes, I would say
that's... Like Michael Blayo.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
So
yes.
He gave you some
So he
some
grafted a lot of our trees, our first trees.
Nice.
So, you know, there is a lot of information, and there are a lot of... there are a lot of classes. There are a lot of, like I said, we're a test orchard as well. So, you know, when you don't even have to be in the business. I think you do have access to all of this type of information, but you can visit the test orchards and inform yourself. So, you know, on that level, I want to say in Quebec and in Canada, we're very well organized as far as information and, you know, all the latest findings. And so more and more of those findings and tests are on organic. So, you know, we're very lucky in that sense. You know, we are working towards a common goal.
So there's a network. There's a network of apple growers.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes. Hmm. Yes.
Nice. And do you find that since you started the orchard, that the interest in these kinds of farms and these kinds of operations is increasing all the time?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. People now seek out organic agriculture, and we're lucky enough that, you know, the younger generations that are coming out of agronomy school or that are simply interested or that simply love to work outside, you know, there's a whole network of these kids, I want to say, that don't want to work in conventional. They want to work outside. They want to work, you know, on farms, but they don't want to work in conventional. They want to work in organic operations. And so we're lucky enough that a lot of those youngsters, once they're finished, you know, with the vegetable farms, well, comes along fall, and so the timing is really great. And so we get them because they're looking to work on organic farms. So we're really lucky in that sense. We've really sort of got a niche. It's beneficial to us in many ways.
Nice. And you do grow, you do offer some other products in your store here on the farm. And some of those products you might transform yourself, or
yes.
What are some of those products?
Well, we started with apple juice because we had a lot of seconds, and so we had, you know, in the first years we weren't as good at this as we are now. So we have gained quite a good amount of experience, and so you know we would end up with bushels and bushels and bushels of apples that just weren't you know good really for selling directly to the public or at the farmers market, and so we started pressing apple juice. So we got really good at pressing apple juice. We actually just put in a new factory last year. And so now we, you know, our capacity has almost doubled. And so we're never going to run out of juice again, I'm hoping. Hoping. Fingers crossed. But so apple juice was our first one. And then we certified the apple juice as well. So it was easy enough to certify the apple juice because there's no added sugar, no added water, no added preservatives. And so it was pretty easy, just fresh pressed apple juice, and we freeze it. So that was pretty easy to certify organic. We also do apple cider vinegar. So again, you know, quite easy to certify that as well. And, you know, obviously...
Do you need a whole technical operation for the vinegar?
Well, you actually don't need... It's not very difficult. It's not very complicated. You need the space. And that is the hardest thing. Because if you're pressing apple juice in the same area that you are producing vinegar, the natural levure, the natural yeast that's fermenting from your vinegar will actually, you know, affect your juice.
Oh, so you got to keep them separate.
They have to be separate. They have to be in separate areas. So it was, for a while there, we were having a hard time with those two because we didn't have the space. So now with the new juice factory, well, that was one of the reasons for the new juice factory was to keep those two products apart from each other. And then, you know, we have the classic, you know, apple pie and muffins, and I also expanded the line off to mustards. I love mustards, Dijon mustard, so I have an apple mustard. I also have a honey mustard because we do produce honey, and a Saskatoon berry mustard as well.
Mm-hmm. And you have honey, like you said, and that's from your bees as well.
Yes, from our bees. So lucky enough, in an organic orchard, you can keep your bees with you throughout the season because you're not using chemical insecticides.
Right, because if you're a conventional apple orchard, as you were saying, they bring in the bees for the pollination and then they take them out because otherwise the pesticides will kill the bees.
Yes, exactly. Yep, yep. Your insecticides are not, you know, you'll be wiping out your your bees, basically.
It seems like such a strange
thing. It doesn't it? Yeah. It's very strange.
That's it.
Because we're organic and we don't use pesticides, we're not using Roundup underneath our trees. As you can see, all the trees, you know, it's green everywhere. We've got grass and clover everywhere. And so, but we need to weed eater around every single tree a few times a season.
And why is that? Because the weeds are bad for the trees.
Well, you need to keep it under control, basically, because you don't want weeds that are coming into competition with your tree, and it's just make it that much harder for the tree and for the apples. But at the same time, you see how the branches go really, really low to the ground. So you do need to keep it clean. Otherwise, you'll have rotting apples on the ground. And then again, if you don't get rid of those rotting apples right away, they will bring in disease the next year. So you really need to keep an orchard extra, extra, extra clean to avoid disease. And so one of the solutions we're thinking, because it's so much manual labor to do for the upkeep, I can't imagine, you know, we have 3,000 trees. I can't imagine doing this in a 30,000 tree orchard. I mean, it's almost, you know, it's I don't think it's doable, honestly. But chickens underneath a tree in a proper cage could A, mow the lawn, B, fertilize the grass, and three, eat insects.
And you just move the cage along, right, on wheels?
Thinking we'd like, because it's so close, we'd like to have sort of, our prototype is actually round underneath and actually goes around the trunk. And so we're thinking, anyway, we've got a few ideas, but we're thinking it might be something that could be interesting for us to use.
And in the conventional orchard, so they're not only just using insecticides on the tree itself, but they're keeping the weeds down with Roundup and stuff like that.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, with pesticides.
Yeah. Because I think a lot of people don't even realize all the variety of chemicals they use, you know. There's
a chemical for everything.
Yeah.
You can keep your apples on the trees 10 days longer with a product called Retain. So when the weather is warm, like we've been having this year, September is quite warm, the apples are ripening on the trees faster than if it was a cooler weather, like it should be. And if you see that this is happening, well, you've got a window there where you can use Retain. And the word says it, the name of the product says it, you're actually keeping your apples longer on the trees. So, you know, there's a chemical solution for absolutely everything. Yeah. Whereas our solution will be make more juice. That's basically our solution.
Yeah. And do you, like when you have you pick, do you have somebody go through and then try and clean up all the apples that are on the floor
ground? That's the major job during UPIC, I would say, is we always have, we have great employees. They're so devoted. They're so dedicated. And, you know, no matter the age, we've had, you know, from 14, 15, 30, 40-year-olds. It's one of the most important jobs in the orchard during UPIC is keeping everything clean off the ground, not only for disease, but also for people to realize that we're not wasting anything. You shouldn't be wasting anything. So if you're, you know, picking an apple off a tree and another one falls, which happens all the time, another one will fall just because it got a bit knocked over. And you have to pick that one up off the ground as well because it's not spoiled. And it's probably not even bruised because it's falling in lush grass, right? And then again, if you had put Roundup all over the ground, you know, it would be hitting hard ground, whereas here it's hitting lush grass. It's not spoiled at all. It's perfectly good fruit. So, you know, it's important for people to realize that every fruit, every apple counts. And, you know, I think that, like I said, one of my favorite things about UPIC is really sort of teaching people about that food waste as well. And we have a lot of orchards in Quebec, and some of them get really crowded. And unfortunately, there's a lot of food lost in there because it's taken for granted.
For sure, for sure. Yeah. You know, people just pick an apple, drop it down, or
take
whatever.
one bite, throw it. It's you know, when I'm walking through my orchard and I see one bite taken off an apple, I'll admit it makes me a bit crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Disappointed.
Yes, sure. Disappointed. Yes,
yeah, yeah,
yes,
for sure, for sure. So once again, then, so if people are interested in coming here. Your website is what? What is your
website? Our website is vergerdehudson.com and vergerbiologique.ca. So you've got both addresses there that work. And you need a reservation on the weekends, Saturdays and Sundays, again, so that you'll have a nice picking experience. Weekdays, we're open 10 to 5. We're open 7 days a week, but we're open 10 to 5 every single day, and you don't need reservations during the week.
Okay. And it's pretty easy to find. It's off the 40 or the 417, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Exit 17, I guess.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exit 17. Yes, quite easy. So great. We're right smack dab in the middle of Hudson and Rigo.
Nice.
And we have great products in store.
Nice.
Apples always picked fresh in store as well.
Nice. And do you sell at any markets?
We do. So we're lucky enough to be at the St. Anne de Bellevue market on Saturdays. So that's 9 to 2. On Saturdays at St. Anne de Bellevue, so that's a really great market. I highly recommend it.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Annick, for talking to me today.
Well, thank you for having me.
And that was my interview with Annick Joannis, who is the co-owner of Verger Hudson, which is an organic apple orchard in Hudson, Quebec. And you can find them by looking for vergerbiologique.ca. And they have lots of delicious apples and a few other products, including an amazing granola that I've bought there before that has dehydrated slices of organic apple. Yum. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. The other feature we have for you today on the show is about cell phone radiation. And I think this is a major issue that, of course, doesn't get enough attention. I use a cell phone as well, and I too often put it in my pocket when I go shopping and so on. And after listening to this talk by Dr. Devra Davis, I don't think I'm going to be placing that phone in my pocket anymore, because there are too many unknown negative health effects, and some of them are not even unknown. They're very well known. And then now we have the beginning of a new era in cell phone radiation with the 5G network. So things could get even worse in terms of the negative health impacts from cell phone radiation and radiation from cell phone towers. This comes from a talk which she gave at the University of Melbourne. And here is that lecture now.
When we talk about truth in science, of course, it's always relative. But there are now more than 6 billion cell phones in the world today. 8 billion wireless transmitting devices, more than 50 billion are anticipated to form the Internet of Things, and we have to recognize that we don't know a lot about the public health and environmental effects of this form of radiation. You've mentioned some of my career. I won't go through this in any great detail, but I would say to you that probably the most important thing I did, and I see many people in this room aren't even old enough to remember it, but long time ago, you used to have smoke on airplanes. People could smoke tobacco on airplanes. And I was involved as a young scientist in the committee that actually reviewed the data and recommended that there be no smoking on airplanes. You may be shocked to hear that it was even a question for science at the time, but it was. And when I look at what we know now about mobile phone radiation, I see some very interesting similarities, because there were a lot of questions that were raised about the safety of tobacco on airplanes. And they were, in fact, legitimate questions, things we did not know. There are a lot of important questions to be asked about mobile phone radiation today, without any doubt. But the reality is we're not asking those questions. And with the exception of some researchers here and elsewhere, very little new research is being done in this field. So it's a thrill to be here, because Australia has been a leader in research in the field of electrical engineering and its applications to medicine, doing some of the most exciting work in the world and funded by institutions around the world, including the U.S. Department of Defense. And I've worked at some of the top institutions in the world in science, and so when I first thought there could be something wrong with mobile phones, I actually owned three phones at the time. I own two now. And I, everybody has to downsize a bit. And I didn't believe there was a problem. And I thought if there were a problem, I would know about it because, of course, I knew all about what was important in science. Well, I was wrong. I liked the fact that I could call people or actually send them messages and expect an answer at all hours of the day, and found it kind of fun in the beginning. And when somebody said to me there could be a problem with this with our health, I said, oh, don't be ridiculous. If there was a problem, I'd know about it. Well, I was wrong. And what I now know is that information is being sent to people routinely to give them safety information. But all smartphones come with some information that basically says, don't keep the phone in your pocket or you will exceed the as-tested exposure guidelines. Now, how many of you knew that before today? So that's a good thing. But on the other hand, I think that we all need to do better to give people information so that you have knowledge about how to reduce exposure. And I'm going to explain to you why we need to reduce exposure. Let's go back to almost 20 years ago when standards for cell phones were first set up. At that time, it was believed that the only thing you had to worry about was avoiding heat. That was the only effect you had to be concerned about. And so they employed the head of a very large person, a 220-pound male, who was at the top 98th percentile of military recruits in 1989 in the United States. And they set the standards to avoid heating up that fellow's brain after a six-minute phone call. Now, there's probably one or two people in this room with a head that size. But the rest of you, like most of the world, have much smaller heads and relatively smaller bodies. And this standard, which is very much out of date, doesn't take into account the fact that people the size of these two bright young people here in the front row are using these devices today with no thought that maybe they're getting exposed to levels of radiation that have not been evaluated for their safety in young developing brains. Now, the electromagnetic spectrum, this is information from Arpanza, actually goes all the way from the invisible to the visible. Microwave oven actually happens to be of the same frequency as the cell phone, the mobile phone. The mobile phone and the microwave oven use a very similar frequency. The difference between them is power. The power of the microwave oven is 1,000 watts. And of course, that's power that can heat up a cup of water in maybe 60 seconds. The microwave oven, the mobile phone, the cordless phone, the Wi-Fi monitor, the baby monitor, they all use the same frequency. They differ in power. They also differ because mobile phones and Wi-Fi devices emit pulsed microwave radiation. It's the pulse, not the power, that appears to be biologically most important. The pulse that is erratic and irregular, like for thousands of minutes a month, for dozens of hours a week, over a lifetime, that irregular pulsed signal may be much more biologically important. And in fact, the continuous wave signals have a lot of therapeutic effects as are being applied in medicine today. This is just to show you what happens in a 4-second mobile phone call. This is power density. Power density indicated here. And of course, a phone is on standby. It's not doing too much. But 900 times a minute, it's looking for a signal. It says to the tower, where are you? Here I am. Where are you? Here I am. It's smart. That's how it's supposed to do. Now, when the phone rings, the worst time for you to put a phone right next to your head is when you answer it and say hello, because it's smart and it goes to max power. They're programmed to do that. Max power. Now, it's going to go to max power. You're going to listen, and then it will go up and down and up and down. And again, it's that variation. It's the delta. It's the cumulative integrative dose under the curve over a lifetime of exposure that looks to be biologically important. Now, exposure is a kind of funny thing. There's a rather widely distributed paper by Ken Foster and C.K. Cho that said that the exposure of an adult and the exposure of a child is identical, and therefore there's no real difference in how the radiation might be affecting them. Well, let me explain something. My granddaughter is a very light-skinned, red-haired, blue-eyed child. Her skin is very sensitive. My daughter is darker-haired like I am. If they have sunscreen on, they still will get a different dose of ultraviolet light, even though they have the same exposure. Because the exposure may be uniform, but the amount they will absorb differs because the properties of the skin, the property of the eye, the thinness of the skin, and a number of other variables. And those same things are relevant when it comes to thinking about cell phone radiation. Now, way back in the dark ages, when the standards were developed, two-dimensional modeling showed that children and smaller adults might absorb more radiation than larger adults. And this was scalar modeling that has now been superseded, done by Om Gandhi in 1996. Interestingly, and this is why I'm really delighted to be here, Dean, when he did this work in 1996, he was working with support from Motorola and the Department of Defense. And after he published this, he lost all his funding. So Professor Gandhi, with whom I'm collaborating now, updated his work in 2002, here showing you that a smaller adult head here, you see the amount of exposure is quite similar, but because the head is smaller, it will absorb proportionally more. More recently, we have been working with colleagues at Porto Alegre, with Environmental Health Trust, and we have developed three-dimensional modeling with anatomically based models using MRI to create the models with 1 millimeter voxels. And what we have done is to show the difference in radiation dose in heads of different ages and sizes, right? Now, the next slide is going to show you something that might be of interest to students and faculty here. And that has to do with exposure to the reproductive organs. We call them the gonads. I think you say the testicles. And bone marrow, and look here at the radiation as it gets into the groin area. And that's just from having a mobile phone modeled into the pocket. The United States magazine Consumer Reports recently recommended that nobody keep a phone in their pocket. Nobody. And in fact, if phones were tested in pockets, they would exceed the as-tested exposure guidelines, which is why Telstra has recently issued that advice. We've developed the Baby Safe Project with colleagues at Yale to advise pregnant women to protect their abdomens from mobile phone radiation as well as from iPads, which I should add, iPads and other devices are called tablets because they belong on tables. They are tested 20 centimeters away from that big guy that I showed you before. 20 centimeters away, they are not approved to be held in the laps of little children, although millions of kids are having them now in schools because the people involved in educational technology and those involved in public health research are not talking to one another. Because if they were, they would understand that you're giving children a two-way microwave radiating device, and if you must give them such a device for learning purposes, put it on airplane mode, so that it's not sending and receiving signals as it does otherwise. The problem we face is that right now, we're in the midst of an experiment on my grandchildren and your children, and we don't have anybody to compare them with. We don't have a control group in science. When you are given a drug, it's usually been studied where some people get the drug and some people don't get the drug, and they're called the controls. And then you see whether or not those who got the drug are healthier than those who did not. And when you get results, you can conclude if there is a difference between the exposed and the control group that your drug has worked. Well, when it comes to mobile phone radiation, we've lost our ability to have a true control group. So, where are we with respect to research on infants, toddlers, and young children and pregnancy? Well, there's almost no research underway. NATO may be familiar to some of you, and NATO for years has supported research on radar. Radar, of course, gave birth to the microwave oven. How many of you know that? Okay, the first microwave oven was called a radar range. The guys figured out that they could cook things with radar, and they thought it was pretty cool. They actually discovered it because when guys would be standing on the deck and it was cold at night, they would warm themselves in front of the radar, and if they had chocolate in their pocket, it would melt. So that's how they decided to figure out what would happen if you beamed radar at things like hot dogs and corn, and soon enough, that gave birth to the radar range. But women didn't like the idea of cooking with radar. Guys thought it was pretty cool. So they rekindled the name to microwave. It sounded dainty and more palatable. And nowadays, a microwave oven is a staple around the world. Experimental studies have been supported by NATO on radar for years. And one of the laboratories they've supported is that of Professor Nesrin Sahan and her colleagues. And the Environmental Health Trust convened an international conference with her laboratory partners and the Ministry of Health of Turkey in 2011, and I want to show you briefly some of the work that developed from that laboratory. This is showing you cellular damage that occurred in animals that were prenatally exposed to mobile phone radiation that was produced by a computer simulating the mobile phone exposure under controlled conditions, right? So, because you can't really get rats to make phone calls. You've got to model the exposure. And what they did is they measured in, these are your controls that you compare things with, and these were the exposed. Prenatally exposed, just 15 minutes a day for 7 days. Not much exposure. But these are small animals, and they grow within 3 weeks. They reproduce. And what they were able to study was changes in liver malonaldehyde, which is a measure of peroxidation. It's a measure of damage to the liver, right? So these animals basically had significant damage to their liver if they had been exposed prenatally compared to controls. Now, another group in Turkey has looked at prenatal effects on the brain and the testis. And, you know, a lot of countries, this is a very important research that has been done here. And they looked at counting the number of cells in certain areas of the brain, the hippocampus, which is a critically important part of the brain. And since I see there's a lot of non-expert here, let me just explain that your hippocampus is pretty important to things like memory, balance, things like that. So studying effects on the hippocampus in animals is kind of a good way to anticipate effects that might develop on intelligence and other things. And they looked at newborn rats after they had been exposed prenatally and compared those who were exposed to those who were not exposed. And they looked at their brain cells, the number of cells, their shape, etc., with established methods for testing this. And this article was published in Brain Research, which is a relatively high-impact journal. And what they showed was that prenatally exposed newborns have basically fewer cells in the hippocampus. Here's the exposed, missing some cells, and here are the controls, which they're compared with. And you can see here that these cells are, there's more of them. Here they're more scattered. And in fact, they did another test of memory. Now, how do you test memory in an animal? You don't have them fill out the crossword puzzle. You test memory in an animal with well-established protocols of learning. You teach them to run a maze and get a food reward, and you see how long it takes them to do that. And what they did, it's a radial arm maze. They trained these animals who were starving to get a food reward, right? And after they did that, they then saw how long did it take them to learn this if they had been prenatally exposed to mobile phone radiation. And what they found was that newborns that had been exposed took three times as long to find their way out of an experimental maze and made twice as many errors. And this, again, is a statistically valid method for evaluating learning. Now, closer to home, so to speak, between the brain and the testis, studies have been done here in Australia at Newcastle by a fellow who's now the pro-chancellor of the university. And these studies have been done taking sperm from healthy men. And one test tube gets exposed to cell phone radiation, and one test tube is not exposed to mobile phone radiation. And then the results are evaluated. And this is a measure of vitality. We measure how well the sperm swim. This is a measure of motility. This is a measure of mitochondrial DNA damage. They have three times as much damage on their DNA if they have been exposed to mobile phone radiation as compared to controls. And now the issue is, why does it take a half a billion sperm to make just one healthy baby? It takes a lot of sperm to make a healthy baby. The answer is because sperm don't know how to ask for directions. But they are easy to study. And these research has been done in India, in the United States, at the Cleveland Clinic, and around the world. So many different studies have been done on sperm damage associated with mobile phone radiation that in the seventh edition of the textbook, Biostatistics in Medicine, Stanton Glantz concludes that the evidence linking mobile phone radiation to sperm damage is causal, meaning there clearly is a cause of damage to sperm from mobile phone radiation. Now, we have a lot of uncertainties in this field. The truth is, we have a lot of uncertainties, but not about sperm. There, the evidence has become rather strong, and it's become clear, so clear that the Indian government has issued warnings about this, that clinics that deal with reproductive problems are routinely advising young men to get those phones out of their pockets, recognizing that this is a hidden hazard to healthy reproduction. This is the data from the Cleveland Clinic showing that men who keep cell phones in their pockets the longest have the lowest sperm count. And again, there are many other studies with similar results. So we can debate legitimately the question of brain cancer, and I would welcome an open and honest debate about that question. But when it comes to issues like this, there really is not much to debate. And it's interesting that the research on this issue comes from people who are expert in male fertility, who started to treat men at infertility clinics and noticed that this was a major contributor to their fertility problems. Now, experimental studies have been done also in India to confirm this kind of damage, not just looking at prenatal exposure or early life exposure, but taking middle-aged rats, 70-day-old male rats, that's middle age for a rat, and exposing them 2 hours a day for 45 days to a computer-generated mobile phone signal. And those results show lower testosterone, which is a very important hormone for a male. Men and women both have testosterone. Men just need a lot more of it. And also increases of DNA damage as measured by certain enzymes. And the offspring had lower fertility. And this is just to show you, this is a normal testis. You see the boundaries, the cell wall. It looks very nice. And this is after microwave radiation exposure. So there are some pretty stunning images that have been generated in the basic biology literature when it comes to these kinds of effects. Now, the breast. The breast is mostly fat, contains a lot of fluid. Things that contain flattened fluid cook faster in the microwave oven. Now, a cell phone can't cook anything, right? Mobile phones do not pop popcorn. That was a fraud. They don't make any heat that we know of, otherwise they wouldn't be permitted. But they do go through things that contain fat and fluid. And we are now working in Environmental Health Trust with scientists at the University of California, San Francisco, scientists, formerly the president of the American Cancer Society of California, because we are seeing women who keep cell phones in their bras. Has anyone seen a woman put a cell phone in her bra? Hands up, please. Please tell them you've heard now why they shouldn't do that. And here I want to show you our first case report from 2009, and we now have many more. This was a Chinese-American woman a Chinese-American woman who used her cell phone 4 hours a day in her bra for 10 years while she was driving. Now, and you drive with a phone on your body. The phone is smart. It's going to go from one tower to another, and it's going to say, here I am, where are you, here I am. And it's going to be going to max power each time it moves from one cell tower to another. And there it was right next to her chest. And the tumors that developed right under the antenna of the phone. Unusual tumors. If people started to use phones regularly before age 20, as most of the world is doing now, there was 4 to 8 times more brain cancer after they had passed 10 years. So now, why is there no increase in brain cancer that we can find in the general population today? Because there is not. And after all, if mobile phones really are important, why don't we have an epidemic today? Well, let me tell you why. First of all, brain cancer takes a long time to develop. How do we know that? We know that because when the bombs fell at the end of World War II, there was no increase in brain cancer in the survivors who had been studied. No increase at all. Until 40 years had passed. It took 40 years for an increase in brain cancer to show up in that highly exposed population. Now think about this. Today, the number of people using cell phones today and using them heavily today is very different than it was even 5 years ago, even 3 years ago. Now you're being encouraged to have unlimited talk and text, right? You didn't have unlimited talk and text 5 years ago or 10 years ago. So the uses and the users of phones are changing radically. In fact, most epidemiologic studies find no increased risk of brain cancer from mobile phone radiation. They don't. Until 10 years of heavy use. And by the way they define a cell phone user in these studies, I'm not making this up, is somebody who makes one call a week for 6 months. Yes, one call a week for 6 months. That was the definition in these studies, which, by the way, don't find any increase. All right? So I'm not saying this to say that they did a bad job. I'm saying that we are challenged here with how do you do a study of something that's rapidly changing while you're studying it. The technology has changed. The way people have used it has changed. We need a major program to fund independent research and training. And it's not easy stuff to do. I hold my hat off to all of you electrical engineers. It's complicated. But in the meantime, people have a right to know how you can minimize exposure. Remember, if you have to give a phone to a child, put it on airplane mode. And think about this. That microwave oven, it works because there's a metal box around the microwave signal, and the signal pings all over the place. Next time you get into an elevator or a train for any length of time, put your phone on airplane mode. Otherwise, that signal is going all over the place, magnifying and coming back. Keep the mobile phone away from you when it's on and you are asleep. And I leave you with this thought from Albert Einstein. The world is not dangerous because of those who do harm, but because of those who look at it without doing anything. So, thank you.
And that was a lecture by Dr. Devra Davis, who is a visiting professor of medicine at the Hebrew University Hadassah Medical School. She gave that lecture back in 2015. And she is an internationally recognized expert on electromagnetic radiation from mobile phones and other wireless transmitting devices. And she is the founder or co-founder of the nonprofit group Environmental Health Trust, which provides basic research and education about environmental health hazards. She also has a PhD in science studies from the University of Chicago. And one other book you should be aware of that was written by Devra Davis is called Disconnect: The Truth About Cell Phone Radiation, What the Industry Has Done to Hide It, and How to Protect Your Family. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. That's all the time we have left in the show. Thanks for listening. You can always email us at equilibrium@ckut.ca, and you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/equilibriumckutmontreal. Thanks for listening to the show, and have a great rest of the day. This is Ryan Young from Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM.
CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
In sunny Manchester. Yo, this is Roos Manuva on CKUT on 90.3 Montreal. Check it out.
Travel near, travel far. It's sickly bizarre. Ain't a sound that plays so. Ain't a sound that stays so. Relevant to all soldier movement. Bringing improvement. Bashment and groovement. See the dub stack high. Quality supply. Tunes you don't.
J'étais tranquille. Je tourne un rond dans la maison.
There's a lot going on in the world today. See how it affects Montreal's Black and Caribbean community. Read the Community Contact. News, features, opinions, music reviews, cultural events, and so much more. Our voices,